great landmass projects great power, but the way Europeans drew maps, you'd think Greenland and the African continent were the same size.
Areas away from the equator are basically enlarged.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, rethinking maps. Also, salsa, a musical mix from other countries, but born in New York.
The whites had their music, the black had Motown, and the Latino didn't have anything, and here comes Fania.
And the Women's Rugby World Cup starts tomorrow in England. Fans are psyched that one of their own could make history.
Emily Scott! Emily Scott is going to go all the way!
Plus, swimmers in Paris undeterred by the Seine.
Think of the rats swimming in it, the people peeing into it, the numbers of houses upstream that still haven't been hooked up to the sewage system.
Yeah, all that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Glad you're with us today. We spend a lot of time in our newsroom looking at maps, and most often the basis of those two-dimensional flat grids goes back centuries to a German map called the Mercator projection. Trouble is, it distorts the size of landmasses. A classic example, the African continent and Greenland appear to be the same size.
Africa is 14 times larger than Greenland.
Africa isn't just big, it's a giant. It's the size of the United States, China, India, Japan, Mexico, and most of Europe combined. This isn't just about size, it's about power and perception.
That's from a new public awareness campaign, Correct the Map. They support an alternative called the Equal Earth Projection Map. Boyan Shavrich helped design it a few years ago. We caught up with him yesterday at the International Cartographic Conference in Vancouver to hear more.
Mercator projection, the issue is that areas away from the equator are basically enlarged. They are distorted and basically make the Africa appear relatively smaller compared to the areas that are closer to the poles.
I mean, it is a map made by a European cartographer, and it certainly makes Europe look bigger. How intentional was that, or is it more a function of what happens geometrically when you try and flatten a sphere into two dimensions?
I wouldn't say it was really intentional. I think the purpose of the map that Gerhard Mercator designed was basically to having a straight line for the ships to travel across the sea. So I think that the original intent was to kind of have a map that will be useful for navigation. And still today, navigational charts are using this projection. And then because the map is used for other purposes right now, not for sea navigations, we don't travel so much across the sea today, then the application is no longer viable. Like, it's therefore, we're not using it so often.
So, Boyan, you helped design the 2018 Equal Earth map. How does your map address this problem of distortion?
So it does not have a property like a Mercator that ship can basically sail in the straight line across the ocean, but it has a different property, which is maintaining the equal area, we call it in the profession. Relative areas between different continents are actually relatively correct to the true look on the globe.
Got it. So the Correct the Map campaign seems to have had some impact. The African Union is now supporting the adoption of your map. How important is that?
I think it's very nice that African Union support their campaign. The team that does that has a very interesting project and could actually help to bring a little bit more correct maps, world maps, into the field outside the cartography itself. We cartographers know what we could supposed to use, but outside of the cartographic field, it could definitely potentially fix and make better maps to be used across the board.
I'm wondering what sort of real-world impact would the adoption of a more accurate map have, do you think?
Well, our hope was basically to give a projection that is more globally used for the world maps and it does depicts the continents relatively correctly, especially for the educational purposes, for schools, so that schools across the world, they can use this particular map projection and the maps for the purposes of showing and teaching young generation how our world looks like on the flat map as much as we can. We were very glad to see that popularity of the projection grew over time, and especially now when this is going on, it's very nice to see that our work is in use, so to speak.
I mean, given that people are really comfortable these days with digital maps and GPS and 3D mapping, do you think that we still need 2D flat maps?
Yes, definitely. We still need the 2D flat maps, especially like we have a maps on the phone, we have a maps on computers, and all of those are still flat. They're not 3D objects. They are flat screens. and the maps, therefore, they have to still be flat. Screens are not 3D yet.
Bojan Shavrich is a software engineer who helped design the Equal Earth projection, which aims to replace a standard but distorted global maps most of us use. The Women's Rugby World Cup starts tomorrow. This edition is a big deal. A record number of tickets have been sold. 16 countries, the most ever, are ready to compete at rugby's biggest event. Among them is the host, England, and there's one British athlete who stands to make history on the field. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
In many ways, Emily Skerritt's origin story mirrors that of a lot of elite athletes. She started playing rugby early, at age 5, loved it right away, and basically never stopped. But her training actually started on a different kind of field.
I loved growing up on the farm. It was the best upbringing ever.
Skerritt grew up on her family's farm in Leicester, between London and Manchester.
There was some potato picking and potato riddling that we used to do. If they were, you know, a driver down or whatever, I could bale a field or plough a field.
Maybe those exact tactile skills don't transfer to rugby, but Skerritt says the work ethic certainly does.
Farming is incredibly tough. Like, I grew up with a dad and a granddad who just worked tirelessly. You know, during harvest season or busy times of year, you probably wouldn't see them a huge amount because they'd be up before you'd got up and would come back in well after you'd gone to sleep.
She has the same fortitude now, and it serves her well. Simply put, Skerritt is one of the best rugby players in the world.
England scrum again, looking good.
She made her World Cup debut in 2010 as a college student. 4 years later, she led England to a World Cup victory, scoring 16 of the team's 21 points in the final.
McLean is Skerritt on a much flatter ball. Emily Skerritt! Emily Skerritt! He's going to go all the way!
Skerritt even went on to serve as captain for Team Great Britain when women's rugby made its Olympic debut in 2016.
If everyone could be like an Emily Skerritt, it'd probably make a coaching job a lot easier.
Sarah Hunter is one of England's coaches and spent years on the national team herself playing alongside Skerritt.
She just seems to have the all-round skill set. The kick, pass, run threat, her ability to see space, her ability to put other people into position, like, it's just incredible.
It can be rare to have a player of that caliber also described as humble, down-to-earth, and approachable. But that is what Skerritt is, and it means a lot to some of her youngest supporters.
After every game, she comes around, says hello to everybody. And I just feel like it's really nice of her to do that.
10-year-old Isla Giles is one of Skerritt's biggest fans. She got hooked on rugby a couple of years ago after watching England play in person.
And the next day, I said that I wanted to go play rugby.
Skerritt knows she's a role model for kids like Giles across the country. It's a responsibility she doesn't take lightly, in part because she didn't have someone like herself to look up to when she was a kid.
People ask me, oh, who was your role model when you were growing up? And I can't name a single female rugby player. They're either male rugby players or, you know, people in other sports, because that's what was visible to me.
Now, though, women's rugby is more visible than it ever has been. Ticket sales for this World Cup have already tripled since the last tournament in 2022. Social media has helped superstars like Ilona Marr become household names. And according to a new report by World Rugby, the sport's global governing body, nearly half of women's rugby fans only discovered the sport in the past 2 years. That has led to real change for players.
The support is totally different. The attention is totally different. The resources, how many staff members we have, what sports science support we get, all of that sort of stuff is massively different.
Skerritt says her first World Cup experience in 2010 was more like a county festival. But this time around, it's her fifth World Cup, a record for the country.
This one's going to properly feel like the best competition in the world.
Coach Hunter agrees, adding that it's major events like this that really make use of that momentum.
I genuinely believe this World Cup could be a moment in time where we look back and go, that was the moment that women's rugby came alive.
Going into the tournament, England is on top of the world rankings. In fact, they haven't lost a game in nearly 3 years.
that gives us a good chance to win the World Cup because we haven't lost. We've played these teams before. We've won against these teams. And I just feel like we can do it again.
Young Isla Giles has a ticket to the final set for September 27th. The journey to get there starts tomorrow afternoon when England takes on the U.S. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Books are about to get cheaper in Denmark. That is a good thing, but not necessarily for a great reason. The country's culture minister says it's due to what he called a crisis in reading. So the country's current 25% value-added tax on most consumer goods will be removed from the category of books. To learn more about this change, we spoke with book historian Tina Lupton, who taught for years at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark.
An example for me, I think, would be English language books, which my kids both consumed pretty avidly when we were living in Denmark. And I would often really be reluctant to buy the latest, you know, endless fantasy series that my son was reading because it was going to cost me $30 in Copenhagen as opposed to, you know, 17 or 18 in the US.
So the rationale behind the elimination of the tax is that the high price of books is contributing to a reading crisis. Is that crisis real? Like, is there data to point to a crisis? Like, what have you seen?
Danish people, by and large, buy and read books at a higher rate than most populations. So even though there's a crisis, it's relative to the general health of reading as a practice in Denmark. Is the data suggest that that's a crisis? Well, yes. I mean, they can see that there's a decline in reading. They have statistics about the libraries. They have statistics about the sales. But I don't think it's any different in Denmark from anywhere else.
Right. Well, as someone who researches reading habits, do you think making books cheaper will address this problem, at least in Denmark?
Well, I think the question of whether I can control consumption is a very interesting one, a very current one. What we're seeing everywhere is, you know, the hypothesis that you can use tariffs, which is essentially what VAT is, to try and control, you know, the consumption of certain products. I would say it will work to some extent, and to other extents it won't, because people don't want to read in the sort of cold medium of print in the way that they once did.
Taxes on essential things like clothing and food are often referred to as regressive taxes because of the disproportionate impact they have on low-income people. Do you see books falling in the same category as clothing and food, an essential item for all people?
Yeah, I do think that there's an argument to be made for that, but it would be clear then that you would want to be looking at other formats for reading as coming under that same category, and that would have to include, you know, access to fast internet, access to audiobooks, printing. I mean, I think Denmark, I mean, what must be said about Denmark is that they already do very well on this front. The library system is almost unrivaled in its efficiency and its funding. There's a library in every sector of every little Danish town, and people have access to an enormous amount of free watching, listening, and new material through those libraries. So the Danish system is already doing a lot to make reading accessible on that front.
What is the most recent book you purchased?
Susan Choi's Flashlight. Great novel. I'm really glad to have read it. And I didn't mind at all paying a little bit extra for hardback.
Tina Lupton is a book historian. She recently joined the University of Pennsylvania after years at the University of Copenhagen. Coming up, we cast our eyes upwards to a bright object hurtling through space.
It's a nice reminder both of the immensity of the universe and also how brief and lovely it can be.
Interstellar comet 3I Atlas, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A mysterious object is hurtling toward Earth from the depths of interstellar space. Sorry to disappoint, but it's probably not an alien spaceship, but rather an interstellar comet about 6 miles across, much larger than most comets. Astronomers like Michelle Bannister are keeping a close eye on this unexpected celestial body. It has been dubbed 3I Atlas. We reached out to Bannister, a lecturer at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, to learn more.
This is a interstellar comet. So it's a world that's quite small, and it has formed around another star. And as far as we can tell, the star that it formed around is probably well older than the solar system. So it could be at least 7 billion years old. And that's pretty exciting. That means we're seeing a piece of the puzzle of how planets get put together across our galaxy.
So it's called 3I Atlas, I for interstellar, 3 as the third such object detected, and Atlas for the network of telescopes that identified it. Do we know where it started this journey and where it's headed?
So we don't know exactly where it started its journey because it was probably well on the other side of the galaxy. And the galaxy is huge and old, you know, on the order of over 10 billion years. And so it has mixed itself over time. You get these big stirring processes from the huge spiral arms, effects called resonances that sweep out and clump and move around material within it. So that acts through gravity. And so as a result, it's hard to say, hey, I can see the star that it came from. So we know it's old, and we know it's also a property that astronomers would call metal poor. So as stars make elements within them, you know, the iron that's in our blood, that got made in our star, the gold that might be in a wedding ring, that gets made in the star.
Wow.
But there are stars that come from a time in the galaxy or a place in the galaxy where there weren't as many of these elements made. And so that metal poor state, that tells us about what the home of 3I would have been like. And it was one of these metal poor stars.
So, Michelle, you've actually seen the image that the Hubble Space Telescope captured of 3I Atlas. Just describe, like, big picture what you saw.
Yeah, so this is a small fuzzy dot.
Okay.
Comets can be, you know, with beautiful huge tails that you see extending across the sky. This is not that at this point. It's still several times the distance of the Earth from the Sun, and it's coming in fast. It's traveling at about 60 kilometers a second, which is also one of the reasons that we know that it comes from an ancient star.
About 38 miles per second.
And because of that, we've got this slow amount of heating happening to it that lifts the dust particles away from the surface. So a comet is often talked about as being a snowy dust ball or a dusty snowball. Think of something that's even more fluffy than the foam on your coffee, but that's got as much dust and dirt in it as the snow you get after a Boston winter piled up on the sidewalk. You have something that is gritty and dusty, and as the sunlight hits it, that's lifting that material. So it's clouded in a dust cloud of its own making.
What would it take to discern what kind of elements, like at the molecular level, might be melting off that comet?
So for that, we measure the light from the comet. So in the same way you get a prism in your window and hang it and you get pretty rainbows scattered across your wall, that's what we're trying to do with the light from the comet. So the light from the sun travels to the comet, reflects off the comet, and we can also see what are called emission lines of the molecules that are in that coma of that comet. And that's a chemical fingerprint. So we're using things like the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile, and we can make maps of the chemistry of this object as it comes in through time. And so that'll tell us how it's changing as it gets heated slowly by the sun.
So are you confident you're going to find those fingerprints, and how do you think it could tell us more about really the story of the universe?
Oh, we've been watching this now. So it was discovered right at the start of July. Yeah, we scrambled to all of the world's big telescopes to be looking at this. So what I'd love to do with this is tell the story of this little world. This is something from an ancient time in the galaxy that's traveling through our solar system. It's a piece of a puzzle we've never had a chance to see close up. You think of astronomy and you think of it maybe as something where it's remote, right? It's in the sky, it's far away. This is right here, right now. These are pieces of things that could have come from a star that may no longer exist somewhere else in the galaxy. That's telling us about what happened at these earliest times. So, yeah, to me, this is incredibly exciting. This is something that's going to let us test ideas of how stars form, how they're born and die, how they evolve. and how objects move over eons in our whole galaxy. And we can test that right from one little comet that we see in our night sky.
I can hear the excitement in your voice, honestly. So for those of us with amateur telescopes, could we actually get a look at this comet?
Yeah, so in the coming months, at the moment it's getting closer to, from our point of view here on Earth, it will look like it's behind the sun. It's just the geometry of how it's moving and how we're moving on the big racetrack around the sun. So there'll be a couple months where it's behind the sun from our point of view, and then it will come out. It will be visible. If you want to go have a look at it, you can see a small dot of light that's older than the solar system.
You're obviously stoked, but you're an astronomer. Why do you think an object like this is exciting, not just for astronomers like you, but really ought to be for everyone?
This is one of the things that tells us about the world we live in. And yeah, there's a beauty and a joy to that, in that we can think about things that are older than the world that we get to experience on a regular basis, but are also very much of our time. This little world has traveled for incredible lengths of time, longer than there's been any humans on Earth, longer than people have been hoping and dreaming. But this is the moment we get to see it. It will go through the solar system and out the other side, and our children's children won't get to see it. This is the one for our time. We'll see it for 2 years or so, and then it'll be gone. So, yeah, it's a nice reminder both of the immensity of the universe and also how brief and lovely it can be.
That is special. And do I understand correctly, you joined us for this interview as you're waiting to go into labor?
That is correct.
Wow. Major respect.
Yeah, at the moment it's mostly hurry up and wait.
Just curious, any thought about naming the baby after the comet? Or maybe you should name the comet after the baby.
The baby is definitely not getting named after any of the three interstellar objects we have. The naming scheme for these is kind of lovely, though.
Three-Eye Atlas might not go over too well in grade school.
My husband has happily ruled out it getting named after a moon of Saturn as well.
Michelle Bannister is a lecturer at the University of Canterbury, New Zealand. She's been speaking with us about Three-Eye Atlas, an ancient comet hurtling through our solar system. Michelle, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
More news and stories a little closer to planet Earth are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Depending upon whom you ask, salsa music might be going through something of a renaissance, driven by artists like Puerto Rican superstar Bad Bunny, who released salsa-laden tracks in the past year, or simply because the music is timeless. You may not know it, but salsa was born in the U.S., in New York City to be precise, before it was exported around the world. Miguel Santiago Colon reports from New York.
Our story starts in the mid-1960s when the then-new musical genre was being developed and on its way to taking New York by storm. Salsa came right after the Boogaloo trend that had a hold on these communities. Boogaloo was developed by Cubans in New York, but after the Cuban Revolution, managers, nightclubs, and audiences weren't too excited by something related to communism. No, the music needed to sound like it came from New York. As Boogaloo was fading, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Colombians, and other immigrants were combining the sounds of their countries using Boogaloo as their starting point. They still carried that particular Cuban sound, but with a New York twist.
Por lo tanto, esto tenía que sonar neoyorquino, tenía que sonar fuera del comunismo de Cuba. A eso le llamaron salsa.
That's Elmer González. He's a salsa historian and the host of a long-running salsa show on Radio Universidad, a local public radio station in Puerto Rico. He said that that combination fused into salsa. It was faster, dirtier, with lots of trombones, congas, cowbells, and made to dance to. In part because of that, the songs became longer. And a lot of salsa song lyrics dealt with the social issues, the immigrant experience, heartbreak, and more. That made it all the more relatable to the audience. Salsa was centered in New York, but Latinos kept experimenting with it in other cities too. It played in nightclubs, in the streets, parties, you name it. If the place had a hint of a Latino presence, they were playing salsa. But with all of that, one question remained.
Y llega entonces lo que yo le llamo los mercaderes del arte.
How do we make money out of this? Turns out, as González says, that question was the first step that would lead to the creation of the legendary salsa label, the Fania.
Con suerte de que lo que grababan, aunque tenía muchos defectos técnicos y musicales, empezó a gustar a un grupo de la.
According to González, at first, the Fania, founded by Dominican Johnny Pacheco, recruited little-known musicians and people they picked up from the streets. So, because musicians were hungry for a better sound and bigger audiences, they collaborated on each other's songs to make them better. As a result, Fania's name kept growing with more recognition as time passed. Here's how Pacheco described that era when salsa began taking a hold on Latino communities.
The whites had their music, the black had Motown, and the Latino didn't have anything, and here comes Fania.
Eventually, the label grouped many, if not all, of the biggest names in salsa. Tito Puente, Héctor Lavoe, Willie Colón, Celia Cruz, Cheo Feliciano. If they were big in salsa, odds were they were signed to the Fania. And they often played together at clubs around New York and other cities too.
Es una estrategia de mercadeo común, o sea,
Elmer says that grouping artists together at shows was a pretty common marketing tool. But salsa was still new and thought to be very niche. You know, heard by the working-class Latino communities that would frequent nightclubs. The same groups of people that had left their homes for a better future. The same ones that enjoyed dancing and music that reminded them of the culture and places where they came from. These venues were packed, and the Fania did make money. But they were just small clubs, with a couple thousand dancing fans from Latin America. There was little expectation the music would reach a wider audience. But the label's founder, Johnny Pacheco, knew they could be bigger. And he came up with an idea to market their catalog to reach more people. Why not produce a big show headlined by the record label's biggest stars? I mean, the Rock and Rollers were already doing that, and we still talk about Woodstock today. In 1973, Pacheco and his producers wanted to prove that they were more popular than what everyone thought and expected. They wanted to prove that they were in the big leagues. So why not have a concert where the big leagues play?
The best description I can say, it would be like the American public going to see the Beatles. You know what I mean?
For the world, I'm Miguel Santiago Colón, New York.
Tomorrow we celebrate the anniversary of a salsa concert to beat all concerts at Yankee Stadium.
When I read that the Fania All-Stars were going to be in Yankee Stadium, so it was like getting a message from Jesus, I swear.
The legendary Fania All-Star Show at Yankee Stadium, that's tomorrow on The World. Oh, yeah. Parisians are throwing parties of their own this summer along the Seine at three new swimming sites. You'll recall that ahead of the 2024 Olympics last summer, Paris famously attempted to clean up the river and make the hardworking industrial waterway swimmable. Let's just say the elite athletes tried with mixed results. A year on, regular folks looking to cool off are giving it a go, some diving in with enthusiasm, others more cautiously, like reporter John Lawrenson from our partners at DW, Deutsche Welle.
I was more than skeptical when I got out of the metro and walked the short distance to the river. Think of the rats swimming in it, the people peeing into it, the numbers of houses upstream that still haven't been hooked up to the sewage system, the industrial waste, quite possibly, although given the state of French industry, it would be almost good news to have this sign of life. Even the swallows seem to scream, "Don't do it." But when the swimming station, as Paris Town Hall calls it, comes into view, I'm kind of starting to get into it already. Paris has opened three swimming spots, one near the Ministry of Finance, one near the Eiffel Tower, and this one near Notre Dame in the oldest part of Paris, in front of the island in the river that is the Île Saint-Louis. We're like 10 in the morning. It's a beautiful day. There's some quite classy wooden decking, and the whole swimming area is shaded by some tall plane trees. The queue, like the Seine, moves swiftly. But I have time to ask one of the staff about the incredibly short opening hours here and the fact that you're only allowed into the water if you strap on an inflatable yellow floaty thing.
En fait, à partir de 11h30, la navigation est ouverte. Donc il y a tout qui passe. C'est pour ça que ce site-là, on est fermé à 11h30.
Ah, okay. D'accord.
We close here at 11:30 a.m., she explains, because that's when navigation starts on the river. The bateau mouche, sightseeing boats, barges, and so on. You wouldn't think it'd be dangerous, I suggest, because the swimming area is delimited. We want zero risk, she replies. We don't want a swimmer getting caught in a propeller. Same logic for the rather infantilizing floaty things. They don't want anyone staying under the water.
Okay.
Making the Seine clean enough to swim in has cost about 1.4 billion euros. It's a project very much associated with Paris Mayor Anne Hidalgo. She doesn't want a nasty accident making it look bad. In any case, I am now down to my trunks and with required yellow floater dangling, doing something, to be quite honest, I never thought I would do. Going into the River Seine of my own free will.
It's actually quite nice. I can feel the current. And it is beautiful, I must say. The bridges, the lovely buildings of the Île Saint-Louis, the poplar trees down on the quay. It's really lovely.
So I love it, basically. And so does everybody else.
So what did you think?
I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It sort of feels cleaner than you would expect. It's certainly cleaner than filthy beaches around the Laguna of Venice or something. It's feels like a lake. It's lovely.
And what about the floaty thing that you have to attach yourself to?
Not a problem, really. I love it.
Yeah, can I ask you what you thought of this?
This was wonderful. This is a wonderful experience that we haven't gotten to do in a really long time. A different experience of Paris that all of the people that I've talked to that wanted to do this have never got to do, right?
And how about the cleanliness of the water?
We compared it to a river. But not as fishy as the rivers that we're around. So we'll take it.
The temperature was really, really nice. The current, I mean, it was very calm. Yeah. In terms of cleanliness, I don't know. It didn't seem that dirty. I didn't see that much like plastic or waste. Algae, obviously, but it is a body of water, so normal.
It was nice. Cold, but not so cold. And the weather was nice. And just swimming next to my house is nice.
Wow, cool. You live right here?
Yeah, 5 minutes away, so it's cool. Every day I come.
It's going to completely change your summer in Paris.
Yeah, it's like we're in Marseille now. Almost.
Though afterwards, I venture to the deck chairs not far from the swimming zone, where some swimmers are now chilling, but where some others are holding out against the whole swimming in the Seine thing.
Would you be tempted by a little swim in the Seine?
I mean, I would be tempted for a swim. It's very hot, but not in Seine.
No.
At least not in this area. Maybe like further away.
Why not? Why not? It kind of looks...
No, but it was like full of like trash, just like 100 meters that way. Yeah, like bottles and everything. So.
Okay.
No.
But here it looks kind of clean though, you must admit.
It is.
It looks clean.
It looks clean, but I feel like it can't be clean.
So, any unwanted effects after my swim? Well, funny you should ask, because even though I felt great, I did notice a slight burning sensation in my chest, which lasted a couple of hours. So here's my advice. Smoke, don't inhale. Drink, 3 glasses max. Swim in the Seine, yes, but with your head out of the water.
Life advice from reporter and opinionated swimmer John Lawrenson. He's with our partners, DW. The eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo was supposed to be calm by now, but the warring parties there have ignored a ceasefire and have refused to sign a final peace agreement. As the conflict between militant groups and the Congolese military has dragged on, troubling reports of violence in the fight have trickled out. A note here that this story does discuss atrocities. This week, human rights groups, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, published reports on eastern Congo based on eyewitness testimony. They include allegations against both sides in the conflict, the militants supporting the Congolese army and a rebel group supported by Rwanda. That last faction, the M23 militia, said that the Human Rights Watch report was fake and a falsification of reality and extremist propaganda. But the Amnesty International report also reached similar conclusions. Tegere Chaguta is regional director for East and Southern Africa for Amnesty International, based in Johannesburg. We spoke earlier today.
The report we have just released documents how between February and May of this year, the Rwandan-backed M23 fighters have summarily killed Congolese civilians, attacked hospitals, abducted patients, and tortured and forcibly disappeared civil society members.
And where exactly in the DRC are these atrocities taking place? In the east somewhere, right?
Yes, these atrocities have been recorded in the east, particularly in the cities of Goma, in Bukavu, and in the greater eastern DRC region.
Do any of these abuses, from what you have heard, amount to war crimes under international law?
Absolutely. The violations that we have unearthed certainly could amount to war crimes. We have unearthed violations that relate to reckless disregard for international humanitarian law by all factions and sides in this war, including the Congolese army itself, the Rwandan-backed M23 group, and by the armed militia.
Some of the details that witnesses provide are just too gruesome and violent to repeat on air. But have you spotted a common thread or a pattern?
Certainly there is. We find that the kinds or violations that people have been subjected to show a particular pattern. The report is very clear on several incidents, which you're right, are too graphic to repeat. But what we have found is that the M23 have used gang rape against women to punish civilians. And we've also found that the Wazalendo and the Congolese army have done the same.
Why would these groups target civilians like this? Like, what purpose does that serve, especially if both sides are targeting the same civilians, as it seems, and don't you want the people on your side?
What we find is that these groups essentially punishing civilians. It is unfathomable the kinds of violations that civilians have been subjected to. From the M23, for instance, the Rwandan-backed M23 that have moved into eastern Congo, we have uncovered incidents where civilians have been attacked, punished for being perceived to be allied with the Congolese army. We've also found evidence of the Congolese army alleging and accusing ordinary members of the public for being allied to the Rwandan-backed M23 group itself. So essentially, civilians are caught in between these two fighting parties in this conflict.
Yeah, so let's continue with that, because the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels take up a lot of the international headlines in this conflict. I think you are referring to these fighters known as Wazalendo, who are discussed in report. Who are they?
The Wazalendo collection of armed groups that have been in this region for a very long time. It's important to understand that the fighting in the eastern Congo has been going on for over 25 years. And in that time, there are several groups of different persuasions that have from time to time risen up to defend local interests. So, for instance, as we speak, several of these groups are actually allied to the Congolese army. And what we have found is that the Congolese army that has armed these groups to defend themselves against the incoming M23 group that is backed by Rwanda.
So, as you said, this group Wazalendo was backed by the Congolese army. Has the Congolese military, said anything about the atrocities Wazalendo fighters have reportedly committed?
We shared preliminary findings of our research, and previous research has been shared with them. But up to now, we have not heard any official response to the findings of our research from the Congolese army.
What does Congo's national military say about any other fighters committing atrocities, including M23, supported by Rwanda, or even atrocities committed within their own ranks?
The Congolese army itself has not come out to comment on either the activities or the atrocities that are committed by the M23. What we know for certain and can say is that over the years that there is impunity for violations that have been committed by members of the Congolese army. The failure to investigate and prosecute these is essential to that.
I mean, given what's at stake for civilians, why has there not been more urgency around the globe or even within Africa to establish peace in the DRC?
That is the question that we all ask. Certainly, the people have suffered the most during this fighting. They have been denied justice. We have generations now that have lived through this war, and we continue to not see the relevant political will and practical action to ensure that this conflict ends. And that practical action for us is a determination to ensure justice and accountability, to ensure that violations are investigated and perpetrators brought to account. That is the only thing that will stop the impunity and stop the violence in Eastern Congo.
Tegere Chaguta is Regional Director for East and Southern Africa for Amnesty International, based in Johannesburg. You're listening to The World. In 2015, a group of filmmakers in Hong Kong produced a movie made up of five short films, each imagining what the city would be like in the year 2025. The movie, called 10 Years, imagined a bleak future for Hong Kong, where the government conspires with gangsters, police officers beat unarmed protesters, and information is censored. Sound familiar? It was a hit with audiences and, not surprisingly, angered the Chinese government. 10 years on, reporter Alan Yu reconnected with one of the filmmakers to see how his grim imagined future compares with reality.
One of the short films opens with the smoldering remains of a person who had burned to death. A newscaster reports that this person had died in front of the British Consulate General in Hong Kong. We later learned that it was a protest against the UK giving control of Hong Kong back to China in 1997, after years of colonial rule, and standing by as China breaks the agreement to give Hong Kong a high degree of autonomy. Director Kiwi Chow says that when he imagined the future of Hong Kong 10 years ago, he started with a question. Freedom and democracy often comes after a long struggle. So what would drive someone in Hong Kong to an extreme form of protest? He says he came to that question out of anger. Since the 1997 handover, the Chinese government had dangled the prospect of letting the people of Hong Kong freely choose their own leader, only to break that promise again and again. I thought the government and the whole world was lying to me. I was angry to be living a lie, but didn't quite know how to express what I was feeling. What he did was write this short film, which became part of the 10 Years anthology movie. His film unfolds the mystery of the person who burned to death in protest. It also follows the lives of two young students advocating for Hong Kong's independence, torn between peaceful protest and more militant activism. The movie 10 Years was a big hit when it came out in Hong Kong in 2015. It came out a year after huge pro-democracy protests took over major streets in Hong Kong for months, which became known as the Umbrella Movement. One of the student activists who helped start the protests, Nathan Law, says the movie spoke to the concerns that brought so many people to the streets.
It was indeed a cultural phenomenon. It's not only like a movie that is entertaining or that is visually stunning, but it was indeed a reflection of the collective anxiety about the future and a reflection of the worries about the changes of Hong Kong down the road.
Cinemas had completely sold out shows for 10 years. But after 2 months, they stopped showing the movie after a pro-government editorial criticized it as being an absurd fantasy and a, quote, thought virus. Kiwi Chow says this shocked him.
即是你问到香港社会是资本主义是赚钱。
Hong Kong is a capitalist society. People want to make money. And here you have a critically acclaimed, sold-out movie that no cinema wants to show. We all knew this was self-censorship or official censorship. In response, community groups organized their own screenings in churches, schools, even one at a plaza outside a shopping mall, which Chow attended. He remembers it was so crowded. Some people sat behind the screen to watch an inverted image of the movie.
變咗一個好大嘅一個示威，好大一個對呢一啲禁制娛樂。
It became a demonstration against the censorship of entertainment, film, and art. I dare say it's a form of protest to tell the world that if you want to ban this movie, then I'm going to watch it, because Hong Kong is a free society.
另一样,不单止更重要的是里面的内容,其实是讲紧
At the time, even some of the production crew felt like the movie stretched reality, as Chow recalls. There was one scene where two riot officers beat an unarmed protester with batons, while another protester lying on the ground screams at them to stop. At the time, my cinematographer wondered if this was too far outside reality, because this would not happen. And yet that indeed happened in Hong Kong, just 4 years after the movie came out. In 2019, millions of people in Hong Kong protested a bill that would have let the government extradite people to China. It led to huge street protests, some peaceful and some violent.
10年有一句宣传语就叫做
There was a tagline for 10 years, the future we don't want to see. And yet, in 2019, the government proved to be more evil and more violent than I had imagined. During these demonstrations, officers beat protesters, even fired their guns at some of them. That was shocking to people in Hong Kong at the time. In 2020, Hong Kong passed a national security law, which brought it much closer to the dystopian future Chow and the other filmmakers portray in the movie. Chow says that back in 2015, he and the other directors would joke around that maybe by 2025, cinemas in Hong Kong would show 10 years again, and they could all watch it together. Now it's either laughable or pitiful how naive I was back then. Many pro-democracy lawmakers and activists have either fled Hong Kong or have been detained. Activist Nathan Law now lives in the UK. He sought political asylum in 2020 and is still wanted in Hong Kong under the national security law. Kiwi Chow continues to make movies in Hong Kong. However, two of the other directors who worked with him on 10 years have since left to live in the UK and Canada. For The World, I'm Alan Yu.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. You can be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. Carolyn Beeler is back tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Alisa and Mike Wilson, Carol Bushka, Eugene G. Park, Lisa and Peter Krause, Ricky Etherly, and Robert Lang. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.